Next case for argument is Cyber Foods versus Wang, Li Wang, Mr. Smith. Mr. Schmidt.
May it please the court, my name is Wick Schmidt, and I represent the appellant in this case, Schreiber Foods Incorporated. This case arises out of a $600,000 sale of whey powder for shipment to China, for which Schreiber never got paid. On May 25, 2007, the defendant, Li Wang, solicited a price and quantity quote from Schreiber for the whey powder. Juliet Prescott of Schreiber quoted a price and a quantity available to Ms. Wang on May 29, 2007. On May 30th of 2007, Ms. Wang responded that she had conferred with Geely, a large Chinese dairy conglomerate that was supposedly the sole customer of her cousin Cade Wang's Chinese trading company, and persuaded Geely to accept Schreiber's price. Ms. Prescott responded to that email by asking for confirmation that this really meant that...
What has happened to this stuff you shipped for which you want the $600,000? Now, where is it now?
Alas, Schreiber was able to find it. Most of it was at the Chinese headquarters of one of Cade Wang's trading companies. There was one portion of the shipment, I think 5 to 10%, that was not picked up by Mr. Wang in China. Schreiber was notified by American President Lines, the shipper, about a year afterwards that it had this whey powder and it wanted a whole bunch of money for storage. Schreiber said, at this point, this is worthless to us. This is a perishable product that has a certain expiration date. And American President, you should have told us this earlier. Not only are we not going to take it back, we're not going to pay your storage costs either.
Well, now, the Chinese custom authorities had impounded some of this stuff, hadn't they?
I don't believe any of Schreiber's shipment was impounded, no.
Well, they wouldn't let it in.
That's not my understanding of the record facts. As far as I know, it was, in fact, allowed into the country and indeed picked up by Cade Wang.
Customs didn't do anything?
They were
perfectly happy with this RM substitute?
There's some dispute as to whether it was resellable in China. It would be our position that there is no record evidence one way or the other on that issue. But at the very least, it was allowed into the country, and Mr. Wang was able to pick it up. And indeed, there was a point at which Schreiber's personnel in China did pay a visit to Mr. Wang's trading company, and there were a bunch of bags of this stuff in the office there.
So did he sell it in China?
We don't know.
Mr. Schmidt, what is the state of the record concerning exactly what it was your client shipped? Was it D-70? Was it RMW-2? And what does the record tell us about that?
The evidence is undisputed that it was RMW-2. There is a dispute as to whether there is any material difference between RMW-2 and natural D-70. RMW-2 is, in essence, a synthetic substitute for D-70.
Well, but isn't what Ms. Wang asked for and what Mature Sky asked for in its purchase order, D-70.
It would be our position that there's an equivalence between, functional equivalence between the products.
Well, but that, you shipped what they didn't order. I mean, it's one thing to say this is just as good, but if you're telling me it's undisputed this was different stuff, why are we having this debate?
We would analogize this to going to a drugstore, for instance, to get Tylenol. And sometimes you get actual brand name Tylenol. Sometimes you get a different product.
And there's a price difference, and it's a consumer's choice, right?
In certain circumstances, yes.
Why isn't the fraud claim here on the other side? If you're telling me it's undisputed, you submitted that you shipped a synthetic substitute.
Now, if there were a fraud claim to fraud, then we would dispute that there's any material difference between the two. That fraud claim would belong to Mature Sky. Unfortunately, Mature Sky has never appeared in the case.
I understand that, but you all are the plaintiffs, and we usually look for pretty clean hands. And you're telling me it's undisputed that you unilaterally decided to ship a synthetic substitute for what was ordered, right?
It is undisputed that RMW2 was the actual product shipped, yes. Now, in terms of
why doesn't that end this case?
Because a claim for intentional misrepresentation in this context is an action at law rather than an equitable claim. And so the
Come on. Look, you're saying Ms. Wong misled you all about what might happen. And you're telling me the evidence is undisputed that you misled her and her cousin about what you were going to ship. We should come and step in and order payment for substitute inferior goods?
We would dispute the any claim, certainly, that they're inferior.
Let's bear with me on this,
substitute,
okay?
Though, right?
That's your judgment. You decided to substitute something you preferred different from what your customer ordered, right?
If you view the order, that would require you to view the order as being strictly for naturally occurring D70 as opposed to functional equivalent of D70. In other words, it would require you to construe the patient's order for Tylenol, say, as brand name Tylenol and nothing else, as opposed to a pain reliever with the functions of Tylenol, which is what you often get when
a druggist can't substitute a generic without telling you.
They do tell you, but oftentimes, having picked up prescriptions myself, you will go in and you'll give them the brand name of the drug you want. Your doctor will prescribe that, and when you show up to pick it up, it is a generic.
Come on. They may say to you, look, the brand name is twice as much as the generic. The generic is just as good. Would you like that instead? If you have a prescription with a brand name in it, they can't substitute a generic. That's illegal.
Certainly, it does seem
it's
that
illegal.
When I get prescriptions,
if the doctor prescribes by the brand name, you can't substitute the generic. Certainly, without telling the customer.
I think another way to look at this question.
Some people don't want the generic. They're afraid it's not manufactured as carefully.
I think another way to look at this question is to go back to sort of the theory underlying an intentional misrepresentation claim. It's sort of a funny claim in that the theory is really, and you can see this in the way the reliance.
Your claim is funny. I don't know what's funny about her claim. I don't understand your claim. You're dealing with this person, Li Wang. You don't know anything about her. She's in the auto parts business, and now she's helping a cousin, apparently, to make a purchase. Wouldn't a reasonable businessman be concerned that about, you know, you're shipping to a foreign country on the advice of a auto parts dealer with a cousin? Why wouldn't you, you know, ask for a letter of credit or some other, you know, assurance of payment, right?
At one point, Schreiber, the concern here was, of course, that Yili, the large Chinese dairy conglomerate, be the ultimate purchaser for the product shipped. At one point, Schreiber did request some sort of confirmation of Yili's involvement, and they got back a...
some sort of confirmation of Yili's...
How about
a guarantee of payment of some sort, a letter of credit, when you're dealing with a foreign company that you don't know anything about, and it's being arranged through a cousin of this auto parts person? It doesn't seem responsible to just... And as Judge Hamilton was saying, you're substituting another product. And you may think it's identical, but if someone asks for X and you ship Y, you might be, you know, concerned. Maybe they're not going to pay. They're not going to like it. They're not going to accept it. And so you would explain to them it's a substitute, and you want some, you know, third-party guarantee of payment.
I think with respect to the substitution issue, again, another way to look at that is the original theory really underlying an intentional misrepresentation claim is...
it's an infant formula, and China has had all sorts of problems. I mean, I think they've executed people for, you know, poisoning children and so on. So this is a concern. So you think when you're substituting a product, you notify them that, you know, you're substituting this, it's just as good and so on, don't worry about it. Then they'll make a judgment whether they can afford to trust you.
What Schreiber did in this case, though, to make sure that the product was acceptable to the ultimate consumers in China, was it provided a sample of the product. And the sample, as well as the final product shipped, was RMW2. And it was Schreiber's understanding.
Wasn't that a handcrafted mixture, though? That was
the
$42,000 shipment, the earlier $42,000 shipment. Was that exactly the same stuff that got shipped later?
The $42,000 shipment, that was a different product.
Okay.
That was WPC-34.
Okay.
See, I think that makes it worse for you, actually. I mean, it makes it really fraudulent, right? In other words, suppose someone goes in, someone wants a shipment of a milk, and you decide you can make some extra money. Instead of shipping them cow milk, you're going to ship them milk from mice. But you're going to doctor it and so on. You're going to play with it so that it tastes exactly like a cow milk. And so when they get it, the mouse milk, they'll think it's cow milk, right? I mean, that's fraud. Now, you could say, well, it's just prejudice that says you don't want to drink milk from mice. It's just as good for you, right? But you can't deal with customers that way. You have to tell them what they're getting.
Well, now, here, the original theory behind an intentional misrepresentation claim, though it's migrated over the centuries into the action at law rather than the equitable side, is really rescissionary. The idea is that the transaction, had the defendant been truthful in the first place, the transaction never would have happened. So here to look at Schreiber's alleged subsequent misconduct, I think, doesn't make a lot of sense. And the theory is we were misled had we not been misled.
The argument, you're trying to get away from that. The argument is that you didn't rely on the purchase order for D70, because that's not what you sent, right?
Certainly the shipment that was made in reliance on the purchase order that was issued by.
But not in compliance with the purchase order.
That would be an argument that perhaps Mature Sky could raise if it had appeared in the case, yes.
Well, Ms. Wang has raised that with respect to the defense of your intentional misrepresentation claim.
And that's where I think, and she does attempt to raise that in the context of arguing that Schreiber's reliance on the purchase order was not reasonable. But here again, I think it's important to look at what the definition of reasonable reliance is. And this comes out of the original rescissionary theory of the intentional misrepresentation claim. The questions for whether reliance is intentional are, one, did the person to whom the representation was made, here Juliet Prescott, know that it was false? And the answer is clearly no. And two, was the representation so obviously false that Prescott should have known? And again, here the answer is no.
But isn't it reasonable to expect that if you're relying upon a promise, if you send 200,000 kilograms of E70 to Mature Sky, you will be paid for it because they have a deal with Yili. That's the representation, right? That you're saying is false, right?
Yes.
How is it reasonable reliance if you say, well, instead of sending 200 metric tons of D70, we're just going to send a substitute?
Because the reasonableness element focuses on whether it was reasonable or not for Schreiber to believe the representation.
So we should focus on the first lie and not the second. Is that the theory here?
There was a second lie, but yes.
Well, what does the evidence show about whether your client told Mature Sky it was shipping a substitute?
Here we did provide a sample, so they were able to see exactly what it was.
When did you tell them that it was a different material?
In Schreiber's view, they're functional equivalents. So
that's not my question. When did you tell? What evidence is there in this record that you ever told them you sent a substitute?
I don't believe there's any evidence that we've told them point blank this is RMW2.
Point blank? What's the force of point blank?
As opposed to providing them a sample so that they could see for themselves exactly what it was.
It's not telling them at all.
You sent them a sample and basically said it was with the assumption that it was their problem to try to figure out whether you had actually sent complying goods. Is that the theory?
Yes, at this point they hadn't placed an order yet. So we sent them a sample. If you like this stuff, you can order it. If you don't, don't. And they had the opportunity to test
the
sample.
So suppose you had shipped D70. Wouldn't Yili have taken it
I don't believe so, because here I don't believe that Yili had ever agreed to buy the D-70 from Mr. and Ms. Wong's companies in the first place. And, again, this is well beyond the record evidence. Schreiber's belief that the real reason this transaction fell apart was not anything involving the content or the character of the goods, but that the bottom fell out of the market for D-70 between the time in early June, late May, when the May 29th, I believe, was the date the price quotation was given, and late September, roughly, when the product actually arrived in China.
Now, what about the economic loss doctrine? Why isn't this a case where Schreiber had perfectly good contractual remedies to protect itself against misrepresentations by Wang? You know, as I say, letter of credit, this, that, correspond with Yili, whatever, right? Lots of things it could have done. Why relegate this to tort law?
Of course.
Sure. Schreiber is a big company. It's dealing with a foreign enterprise, dealing with a person who's in a different business, the automotive parts business. Why not protect itself contractually?
Of course, in retrospect, one always wishes one had, but that would have made the transaction significantly more complicated up front to have had to negotiate directly with Yili. And as I understand it, Yili prefers to work through these trading companies. And who knows, perhaps precisely so it can back out of transactions.
Get the guarantee, get the letter of credit guaranteeing payment by the trading company.
But, of course, we already had a contract with the trading company, and in this case, unfortunately, that's turned out for a variety of reasons to be worthless.
Well, that's the chance you take with contracts.
And that's unfortunate, and that has...
You can ask for payment in advance, right?
You could, but
yeah,
it's unlikely
could.
That it's exactly.
Trading that's, company. That's the whole point. The contract law gives you a complete entire opportunity to trade off, you know, risk of default against complexity of the contract, ask for a guarantee. The trading company fly by night doesn't give it to you, or you don't trust them, or you get a credit check. You don't need tort law to protect yourself against this trading company and Wang.
But, of course, it's difficult to do that when one is entering into a contract under a misapprehension due to an intentional misrepresentation about the background facts that are material to the contract.
You didn't know anything. I mean, you obviously. Schreiber didn't know anything about this trading company, right?
They had dealt with it just in one transaction before, the WPC-34 transaction that had happened in February.
Okay, but they didn't know whether it's a big company and solid, whether it can pay $600,000. I didn't know anything about it. Well, how do you protect yourself against an unknown contractual partner?
It can be difficult because trying to do so can make the transaction much more difficult to enter into in the first place. And when you're selling large volumes of commodities on a daily basis, it's tough to sit down and work out a 20-page contract with each of your customers every time.
Mr. Schmidt, can I ask you about the sale of goods versus sale of services theory that you have? Your theory, as I understand it, in your attempt to rely on the Schuster case is based on the theory that Ms. Wang was acting as a broker and providing her services as a broker. I guess my question is, why doesn't that theory effectively undermine Wisconsin's economic loss doctrine completely? Because there would always be an agent, an employee, someone in any contract for sale of goods who would be in that intermediary role.
In many cases, yes. In this case, what it really comes down to, I think, is their Schuster.
Schuster was obviously based, it's a narrow case, it was obviously based on the specific statutory duties of real estate brokers in Wisconsin, and it's frankly something of a sport in the whole field. But you want to open it wide open.
Well, there I would disagree slightly. Schuster gives three independent reasons for its holding. The first is the absence of privity of contract between the particular defendants whose claims against whom were at issue. And I frankly confess that's not terribly persuasive. The court seems to have overlooked the Dannon and Jansen case there. The second, however, is the idea that a broker is a provider of services rather than a seller of goods. And I do think that that's an independent rationale if one reads through the way Schuster is written from the third rationale which is given, which is the specific statutorily imposed duties that are incumbent upon real estate agents.
Okay, so if we read it the way you do, why doesn't the economic loss doctrine disappear? Because there will always be a broker, an employee, somebody acting on behalf of the buyer and somebody acting on behalf of the seller, the human beings. You want to be able to sue the human being in tort. Right?
In this particular case, yes. In many cases, that's not a particularly valuable claim because the human being tends to be less collectible than the corporate entity.
Well, that maybe it's Bill Gates. Who knows? Okay. But that's the theory that you want to apply. And why doesn't that undermine the economic loss doctrine completely?
Arguably, it does undermine it somewhat, but I think Schuster is the one case here that's really on point on this issue. And if the court is going to follow the way the Wisconsin Court of Appeals has dealt with this issue, it should follow Schuster rather than sort of implicitly ignoring it or overruling it as the district court did.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Mr. Nix?
Good morning. I'm Joe Nix. I represent the appellee, Lei Wang. I'd like to start by maybe clarifying some of the facts in response to one of your questions, Judge Posner. The difficulty with the Chinese customs authorities didn't occur necessarily with respect to the transaction issue between Mature Sky and Schreiber. But the factual background of this is that this wasn't the first go-around that Schreiber had with the trading company. They had dealt with Chinese trading companies before. They knew how the system worked. And at the time that they were talking to Lei Wang about an order by Mature Sky and Zhang Zheng and so forth, they were dealing with a different trading company called Dalian Nu Bai Li. And at that point in time, these things are happening at the same time, the guys from Dalian Nu Bai Li had notified Schreiber that they were refusing to pay because the same product, the RMW-2 that had been shipped to that trading company, could not clear customs. So the point that Ms. Wang was trying to make here was that at the time they decided to substitute the RMW-2 for D-70, Schreiber already knew that these particular products, the RMW-2, were having difficulty clearing customs in China.
Where do we find, is that a part of your summary judgment response in the district court?
It is in the summary judgment, Mr. Shales. There is documentation regarding, particularly in Ms. Prescott's deposition testimony, in the exhibits to it with respect to her dealings with Dalian Nu Bai Li. And it's significant that, it's a large company, so it isn't an employee in one department dealing with one transaction and a different employee dealing with another one. This was the same employee, Ms. Prescott, dealing with both of the Chinese trading companies. I think it's a very valid question, although hypothetical in a sense, to say, well, what would have happened if Schreiber had actually shipped D-70 instead of the RMW-2? We'll never know for sure because that didn't happen, but my guess is that, based upon the relationship between Zhang Zheng and Yili and the success of the first transaction, that in all likelihood, if they shipped the right product, Zhang Zheng would have been able to resell it in China, and then Zhang Zheng would have been able to pay Schreiber. So the whole problem in this case really comes down to, in a large way, the fact that the wrong product got shipped.
That, however, is not the basis on which the case was litigated in the district court. So we need to focus on the economic loss doctrine. So.
Well, that's mm-hmm. correct, and I'd be glad to talk about the economic loss doctrine because We've seen a lot of litigation in Wisconsin the last several years in which the economic loss doctrine has evolved and has been expanded to a certain number of cases and then narrowed. But in a certain sense, I think this is an easier case than some of the cases that the Wisconsin Supreme Court has grappled with, because I think this is really down Main Street for the economic loss doctrine. And starting sort of at the first principles, the idea being that the economic loss doctrine should encourage parties to use contracts and use commercial law to protect their interests and reach agreements that then can be enforceable under contract and court law. From this standpoint, it's obvious that everything the Wisconsin Supreme Court has done in terms of developing the economic loss doctrine hasn't caught up to Schreiber yet, because we have a situation here where we have a large, sophisticated company that was in a very good position to protect itself. And instead, they did, quite honestly, a pretty dismal job with respect to their contracting.
But it is common in economic loss cases, the economic loss jurisdictions, to have a fraud exception on the theory that it's difficult to protect yourself contractually against a fraud.
Well, that's absolutely right, and the different states have found different approaches to it. Some, you know, have a broader definition of the fraud as allowed, and some very narrow.
Wisconsin's about as narrow as they come, isn't it?
Well, I think that was just the point I was going to make, is that if you track through the cases, starting with, you know, with really DigitaCorp and then following the most recent decision in Belo, is that they kind of go through as a fact-by-fact determination in a way, and they kind of get to the point where it's very narrow, and Judge Crooks in the Belo case talks about, well, anything that concerns the subject matter is going to be interwoven, it's not going to be extraneous. And one of the kind of the telling parts of that case for me is that it's to look both at the opinion of the court and then also the dissent by Judge Bradley, you know, who was much more in favor of a broader fraud and inducement exception, and she was, I don't know if complaining is the right word to use or not, but one of the things
in a dissent, that's usually the right word. In a dissent, that's usually the right word.
But basically what she says that under the majority opinion that it was so narrow that she really couldn't determine what kind of case the...
Well, what if Wang had presented skillfully forged documents identifying her as the American representative of Yili and saying, you know, boy, we really want this DR-70 or a substitute, we don't really care, but we really want this stuff. And, and it was a well-forged and everything looked right, you know. Wouldn't they be able to, I find it hard to imagine was... Wisconsin would not permit a suit against her.
Well, that would be a very different case, Your Honor. Schreiber would have a stronger case in that situation. But
it would be
that's
stronger.
Not what
she the did. Question is, how do you draw the line? Because according to them, she has this interest in the trading, you know, the 17% interest, the trading company, and she doesn't reveal that, or she says she doesn't know about it. But how different? How do you draw the line?
Well,
where do you draw the line?
I think the Wisconsin court gives some guidance in that in the two cases where they found that the fraud of the inducement exception applied, and that would be the Colodi case and also in the Wickenhauser case. And the Wickenhauser case is kind of an outlier because the option there really didn't relate to the contract to obtain the loan. But in Colodi, you had circumstances there where the failure to disclose really dealt with an item that the buyer really didn't have any reason to know about and to negotiate about in a contract. The thing that is very different in this case that we have before the court today is that everything was very upfront. You know, in other words, as Judge Griesbach noted in his opinion, that they knew that the success of this transaction really depended upon Ely's purchase in China. That Schreiber knew that, and of course, because they knew about it, then they had an opportunity to do something about it. I mean, there are a lot of things they could have done. I mean, they could have communicated with Yili. They could have gotten a guarantee. They could have gotten a guarantee from someone else. And one of the things that's notable about this case is that in the normal economic loss case, we're talking about a situation where a buyer will commence an action on contract and then try to expand the theories by also suing in tort. And then the reasons for that are kind of obvious because the proof problems might be less in a tort case. There might be a potential for greater damages. But that's not what we have here at all, is that Schreiber has an avenue in tort. I mean, in contract, they could sue Mature Sky. They could probably even sue Zhang.
They could sue whom? Who could they sue for breach of contract?
They could sue Mature Sky. And they have the remedy here. What they're really trying to do is avoid contract law completely and find a different party who they don't even have privity with and sue in tort. And that seems
well,
that would really
they want to sue the only person they dealt with face to face, right?
I think that's a true statement. I think more accurately, I think they're trying to sue the only person that they think they have some possibility of collecting from.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's because not because they don't have a remedy, it's just that the remedy isn't very good because they don't want to go
for 600, yeah.
Does Mature Sky have assets? Is it substantial, or do we know? Or?
We don't know. I'd like to talk next briefly about the questions that you raised, Judge Hamilton, about the services exception under the Schuster case. And it's our belief, as explained in our brief, that case really should be very, very narrowly constricted to the facts of that case. In Wisconsin, Court of Appeals decisions have precedential value, but that court is generally an error-correcting court. And I think that you saw that function in that case, that it was correcting an error, and that the case really falls along the line of previous Wisconsin precedent that dealt with claims against entities such as architects, lawyers, doctors, in which those professionals have a specific duty to the plaintiff. And to me, the Schuster case turned on, the idea that the real estate broker under Wisconsin law had an obligation to both sides, to both the seller and the buyer. And it was that independent duty to the buyer that really triggered the decision in Schuster. And on that basis, I think Schuster should be confined to its facts. One of the things the court in Schuster didn't do is what the Supreme Court in Wisconsin basically recommends the courts do in analyzing these
cases. I don't think you want to say Schuster should be confined to its facts. That's a polite way of overruling a case, right?
I think you want to say it's limited to real estate brokers.
I think that would be a better way to have stated it. It's limited to real estate brokers because in the colloquy you had with Mr. Schmidt, I think you're correct, and it was noted in Judge Griesbach's decision that if you say any person who is involved in a transaction can be sued, well, then that's what's going to happen in every transaction because everyone has to do business, through individuals, and everybody's going to be making representations along the way. And if this type of claim is permitted, then we're going to have a situation where whenever there's a failed transaction, then the party on the short end is going to go back and look through the history of the transaction and try to find some place where someone says something that they didn't like, and you're going to end up in a lawsuit that involves tort claims. I have no further comments unless the you judges have questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Nix. Mr. Schmidt, do you have anything further?
I believe my time has expired.
Okay, if you want some more time, you can have it. Not a lot of time, but you can have a little time.
30 seconds.
I'm very, very, very quick.
Okay, sure.
I would like to address real quickly the issue of the claim that there was fraud on both sides here. And just to say that I think the theory behind an intentional misrepresentation claim is rescissionary. In other words, it isn't like a case where you have fault on both sides you're comparing. And in fact, contributory negligence is not a defense to an intentional misrepresentation claim. Here, the original theory behind the intentional misrepresentation claim is that but for the first intentional misrepresentation, this transaction never would have gone forward in the first place. And so it's improper to look at any subsequent fault on the part of the plaintiff when you have an intentional misrepresentation that sets a transaction in motion that otherwise would not have occurred. Now, over the years, the claim has migrated from the equitable side of the court onto the legal side of the court, and the damages have changed to be something more akin to contract damage, expectancy damages, rather than the original rescissionary damages. But the underlying theory behind the why the defendant is liable in the first place remains the same, the idea that the transaction was induced by a fraudulent intentional misrepresentation by the defendant. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel. Next case for